Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Sunday. This is a Indy Morrell production, Dollhouse Radio. You're listening to Urban Society. I'm your host, James A. Jones. I'm here with my co-host, Martin C. But before I bring Martin in, let me give a shout out to our producer, Indy Morrell. Today is her birthday. So happy birthday, India.
And with that happy said, birthday, India.
Yes, come on in, Martin.
Hey, how you doing, James?
I'm good.
Happy Sunday, everybody. And again, happy birthday to the boss lady, India Morrell. happy 21st birthday. We just gonna say 21 because she's gonna be 21 forever.
Okay,
in her mind.
I'll go along with that because I have read her memoir, but I don't recall her birthday. But I'm not gonna say that anyway, knowing how women are about their birthdays. But hey, 21 forever, I'll go with that.
There we go.
Mm-hmm. So okay, so tonight our topic is going to be, well, let me also say that we're not going to have the Dollhouse announcements tonight, so we're going to go right on into our topic, which is which I've come to call African-American perceptions and the perception of others, more so
yes.
Meaning African-American perceptions due to racism and the perception of others on African-Americans due to racism. And before I start that, I also want to bring this to the fore. It's from a book written by a man named Ralph Ellison. He wrote this book as far back as the mid-century of 1940, 1950, and it was called The Invisible Man. And I want to read right here the prologue of The Invisible Man before we go on into the discussion about what we're going to talk about tonight. So it goes, I am an invisible man. No, I'm not a spook like those who haunted Edgar Allan Poe, nor am I one of your Hollywood movie ectoplasms. I am a man of substance, of flesh and bone, fiber and liquids, and I might even be said to possess a mind. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. Like the bodiless heads you see sometimes in circus sideshows, it is as though I have been surrounded by mirrors of hard, distorting glass. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves or figments of their imagination, indeed, everything and anything except me. Nor is my invisibility exactly a matter of my biochemical accident to my epidermis. That invisibility to which I refer occurs because of a peculiar disposition of the eyes of those with whom I come in contact. A matter of the construction of their inner eyes, those eyes with which they look through their physical eyes upon reality. I'm not complaining, nor am I protesting either. It's sometimes advantageous to be unseen, although it is most often rather wearing on the nerves. Then, too, you're constantly being bumped against by those of poor vision, or again, you often doubt if you really exist. You wonder whether you aren't simply a phantom in other people's minds, say a figure in a nightmare which the sleeper tries with all his strength to destroy. It's when you feel like this that, out of resentment, you begin to bump people back. And let me confess, you feel that way most of the time. You ache with the need to convince yourself that you do exist in the real world, that you are part of all the sound and anguish, and you strike out with your fist, you curse, and you swear to make them recognize you. And alas, it's seldom successful. One night, I accidentally bumped into a man, and perhaps because of the near darkness, he saw me and called me an insulting name. I sprang at him, seized his coat lapels, and demanded that he apologize. He was a tall, blonde man, and as my face came close to his, he looked insolently out of his blue eyes and cursed me, his breath hot in my face as he struggled. I pulled his chin down sharp upon the crown of my head, butting him as I had seen the West Indians do, and as I felt his flesh tear and the blood gush out, and I yelled, "Apologize, apologize." But he continued to curse and struggle, and I butted him again and again until he went down heavily on his knees, profusely bleeding. I kicked him repeatedly in a frenzy because he still uttered insults, though his lips were frothy with blood. Oh, yes, I kicked him, and in my outrage, I got out my knife and prepared to slit his throat right there beneath the lamplight in the deserted street, holding him in the collar with one hand and opening the knife with my teeth, when it occurred to me that the man had not seen me actually, that he, as far as he knew, was in the midst of a walking nightmare. And I stopped the blade, slicing the air as I pushed him away, letting him fall back to the street. I stared at him hard as the lights of a car stabbed through the darkness. He lay there, moaning on the asphalt a man almost killed by a phantom. It unnerved me. I was both disgusted and ashamed. I was like a drunken man myself, wavering about on weakened legs. Then I was amused. Something in this man's thick head had sprung out and beaten him within an inch of his life. I began to laugh at this crazy discovery. Would he have awakened at the point of death? Would death himself have freed him for wakeful living? But I didn't linger. I ran away into the dark, laughing so hard I feared I might rupture myself. The next day, I saw his picture in the Daily News, beneath the caption stating that he had been mugged. Poor fool, poor blind fool, I thought, with sincere compassion, mugged by an invisible man. So, that's the prologue of Ralph Ellison's book, The Invisible Man.
Yes. Anybody, if you have never read that book, I mean, I actually read that book when I was in college, and it is a very striking book. And if you recall the time that he actually wrote this book, this was before there was a Civil Rights Act. This was before there was a Voting Rights Act. It was before, you know, there were still lynching men in the South. It was a very, very powerful book, and for a young man to read that book, I've never met anyone who has read it that it did not have a powerful, influence over you.
Well, me myself, I read it myself when I was in the military. I was maybe in my 20s, and I will say that I read it strictly as a novel, just as something to read. I could relate to what he was saying, but then again, let me put it this way. I could relate to what he was saying based upon what I was reading and understanding. However, as of that point in time, I hadn't gone through any of that he was speaking about. But as time went along, I came to experience what he had written about. However, the thing was, as I now recall, even though I was going through what I was going through, I didn't exactly make the connection with what he was talking about. Basically, because what I was going through, I saw a difference, which I couldn't relate to his book, because based upon what he was saying, as he was explaining what he was saying that he is invisible, that people don't see him, thus at night they tend to, you know, bump him because they don't see him. But in my situation, I was seeing that people saw me. Yes, they saw me because they would even maneuver themselves into my path, although they weren't in my path initially. So based upon that, I couldn't relate what he was saying to my situation. But I would say philosophically, I could relate to what he was saying. But realistically, no, because I also now I will disagree with what he says about himself being invisible. Granted, I understand that that's how he took his situation, as if he was invisible. But no, we are as visible can be. We are seen. But yet our physical, well, we ourselves are just disrespected, even though we are seen. It's absurd. It's outright, it's just ridiculous. Case in point, today even. But then again, I have these situations often, but I will say not as often as I used to, because I now drive. But today I had one of those situations wherein I was walking across the street, and the thing was, it was a white guy, and he happened to have been with a black woman. Again, this is the way it was. He was with a black woman, and he sought to bump into me. But the thing is, if I had walked on as if I hadn't seen him, he would have bumped me. But instead, because I'm aware of these situations, he got bumped. And he was surprised, because he even stopped And because he stopped, because of my awareness is somewhat heightened, I stopped too. And I look back at him looking at me. And I just, you know, like, waved my hand to him like, yeah, you better go on. And he went on about his way and I went on about my way. It was just totally outrageous. But I just got a message from Angela, our executive producer, saying that we're going to go into our first song from Lauren Cameron entitled So High. So this is Lauren Cameron, So High. Welcome back to Dollhouse Radio. You're listening to Urban Society. And we just heard a song from Lauren Cameron entitled So High. That was Lauren Cameron with a song called So High. Our caller number is area code 646-595-4038. That's 646-595-4038. And we right now were just talking about the prologue to the book from Ralph Ellison entitled The Invisible Man. And, well, Martin, question. Have you actually experienced some of those things that I just mentioned, such as walking along the street and then some person just want to walk into you or just bump you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I've had that happen to me, you know, on many occasions. And sometimes you, in your mind, you think to yourself, okay, maybe it's just that they, you know, they're not just paying attention. And then there are times where you just realize that some people, have truly malicious intent in their heart. And it may not even because they may not even know you. It's just that sometimes I think that some people, they just have, you know, they just, there's something missing. That's what my late grandmother used to say, that there's just some people, they just missing. There's missing something inside that makes them a fully functioning human being. You know, you have some people that just completely, you know, there's just something missing in their soul, man. You know, James, it's just I feel like there's something missing in their soul. And I guess I try to think of it that way because my grandparents, they lived through Jim Crow. They lived through, you know, segregation. And they never spoke about it bitterly. They always spoke about it that they felt sorry for some of these people who had hate in their heart for people just because they didn't look like them. You know? It was almost like they pitied these people that they had this, you know, this hate in their heart for those that didn't look like them. And you know something's funny? You have some of these folks who they may have grown up with some black folks around them or people of other ethnic races around them. And the ones that they had personal contact with, they didn't see them like they saw everybody else. I remember the famous scene in Spike Lee's movie. What's the one he had where Radio Raheem got killed?
Do the Right Thing.
Do the Right Thing. Thank you. Do the Right Thing. The famous scene where the actor Michael Imperioli was having a conversation with Spike Lee's character. And Spike Lee was telling him, he said, all the people that you claim to love, he said, you love Michael Jordan, you like Mike Tyson, all of these people that you love so much. And he said, you always say a nigga this and nigga that, and they're all niggas, and you love them. And I remember his character, and this is what I thought was probably made as one of the most brilliant Spike Lee movies there was. Michael Imperioli's character said, that wasn't Michael Imperioli. That was the other guy. I can't think of the actor's name right now. But he said, well, you know something? I mean, those aren't Michael Jordan, you know, Magic Johnson, Mike Tyson. Those aren't niggas. They're above niggas. And that part of that movie always struck me. That he was almost like he had a different category in his mind for certain people because maybe they were a great athlete or a famous actor or something. He just had a different thought process for them. And that like I said, there are people like that in regular life who like they know. They'll even tell you, like, I know Billy and Bob around the corner there, and I've known them my whole life, and those are good people. Those are good people. They ain't like them niggas over there on the other side of the there who be robbing and shooting and killing each other. No, they're better than those people. They're not like those other niggas.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? It's almost like I said, to me, and that's how I can understand how, you know, my grandparents, they almost pity these people because it's almost like the ignorance inside of them, they sometimes, some of them don't even realize it. And then you have those who are just flat out evil. There's just some people that are just flat out evil.
I would attribute that to just a lack of thinking. And then also, a lack of being perceptive. And even worse than that, such people feeling that okay, because that person is black, they're not worth being perceived.
Right.
Basically, that kind of person, that racist kind of person, that is in fact how they do in fact think. when it comes to, you know, someone, let us say black primarily, and or otherly, someone not colored like themselves. But like basically they hold the brunt of their animosity, if you could even call it animosity, toward, you know, well, black people. And going back into something that you had said in reference to your grandmother, I was having a conversation with my mother once, and she had told me, I mean, in reference to what you were talking about, you know, pitying such people, okay, I guess my mother's mother was of that mindset, because according to my mother, she told them, that is, all of her brothers and sisters, that you owe anybody the time of day. And now my mother telling me that, and based upon what I've been through, I had to tell my mother, I had said, well, no, Ma, actually, we don't owe anybody anything, not even the time of day. And I never forget when I said that, my mother, she chuckled when I said that, especially when I said that, you know, not even the time of day, because I had even come to experience that situation wherein people who don't want to recognize me because I'm black, if they do recognize me, they recognize me, well, it's even wrong to say they recognize me, but they see me as someone who owes them something. They see me as, because what I'm saying here is true. I, from that kind of person, I had been seen as owing them something. If it wasn't nothing but the time of day. Because this person approached me, white person, approached me. I was in Germany, and let me say clocks everywhere in Germany. This guy approached me and asked me what time it was. However, there was a clock right above his head. I saw the clock. He's German. He knows clocks everywhere. But anyway, he approached me to ask me what time it was. I told him, I don't know. And he told me, but you have a watch on. I told him, so? He said, you mean you're not going to tell me what time it is? I told him, no, I'm not. And I said, look, man, there's a clock right up there. He said, no, but I'm asking you. I said, well, I'm not going to tell you. He couldn't believe that. Mm. But you see what I'm saying? He felt, honestly, that I owed him the time of day. But no, like I told my mother, I don't owe nobody nothing, not even the time of day, especially if they think and or perceive that I owe them this. Get out of here. But it's sense of
entitlement.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's how that mindset goes. And then further into what you were saying about how that racist kind of person can be around a black person and perhaps have some kind of, you can't really call it respect because that's not what it is, but have some kind of, let's call it camaraderie with this black person, but yet any other black person who he or she don't even know, they're beneath rocks, so to speak. They're not even worth considering and or mentioning. It's just bizarre. So me just saying, in this day, a person with that kind of mindset, a white person with that kind of mindset, I don't regard them at all. I mean, I don't listen to what they have to say, honestly, because I've been around, I'll say that kind of person, racist white person, who has said to me that you're just as good as I am. And I'm thinking, what? To myself, I didn't say this, but I'm thinking, well, you say I'm just as good as you, I'm probably better than you are. You're going to say something like that. And then this person was saying that to me because he was saying that, you know, I'm not like those other guys.
Right.
You know, but right. I resented him having said that to me like that, you know? I don't pity them. No.
You know something, and I used to be that way when I was younger. I didn't. I'm like, why would you pity people like that? But you know something, I think you can justify pitying them because I think a lot of people, you look at them like their lives are much less richer. One of my best friend in the world, he went to college up in northern Missouri. And as you can imagine, northern Missouri probably has a lot of people, racist people there. Also a lot of good people. He went to school with a white guy, Justin. Justin was the only white guy who was in my best friend's wedding when he got married. Justin grew up. Justin was one of those white guys, James, that he was one of them hunting, fishing white boys, like country music, like line dancing, but he also loved Nelly. Nelly was one of his favorite rappers. As a matter of fact, he always used to tell me, Martin, every time I hear you talk, you sound just like Nelly. He loved Nelly. He loved Tupac. And he was not one of those white guys who was trying to be down with the brothers, trying to act black, act white. Because like I say, he was a hunting, fishing white boy. He was comfortable out in a double wide, you know, going hunting with his dogs. And I'll just say this. We were in a situation where some things went down in a bar. And some white guys didn't like the fact that one of our buddies was dating a white girl. And he said something disrespectful. And Justin, when we about to throw, Justin got up. He about to throw with us. He said, these my bros. You gonna fight? We all fighting. And Justin was the first one to throw the shot on the white boy, one of the white boys. He said, no, we're not going to have this. And you would think that coming from his background, and even Justin said, you know, he had a lot of relatives, older relatives, who he said used the N-word. But his father didn't raise him that way. And I had met his father before, and his father, I'm telling you, James, this is where you go where you don't judge a book by its cover. If you saw his father looked like one of them guys that he looked like if you just judged him by not knowing him, you would probably think he done lynched a few niggas in his time. Excuse my French. But he said that his father was raised that way, but he went to end up going to school and having some really good black friends, and it just didn't, for him, it just didn't, what he was taught didn't jibe with what his black friends were like. So he didn't raise his son, Justin, to be that way. And he said, you know something? He taught him, he said, there's going to be some good black people you're going to meet, and there's some bad black people you're going to meet. But you never know unless you get to know them. And like I said, if you ever met Justin, coolest dude you ever want to meet. Coolest dude you ever want to meet. But the thing is, if I just went by my bad experiences, I probably wouldn't even want to get to know him. Because to me, that stereotype of the kind of racist that we've had in this country, a lot of times we have pigeonholed people because of where they come from. And the thing is, I always tell people this, it's not the ones in the sheets you need to worry about. It's the ones that wear their sheets on the inside that you have to worry about. The ones that look like they say they're down for you, but they're really not down for you.
Well, I follow what
you're
saying.
You know what I'm saying?
I do exactly. But what you're saying there is in terms of, you know, an individual, you know, coming out from that nonsense. Just like, let's say, to put it somewhat differently, that's just like some black people have the capacity to raise above their own environment. You know what I'm saying? You know, their own environment of, let me say, ignorance. By the same token, you know, you have some whites who also have that ability to rise above their environment of a racist ignorance. You notice how I had
True.
Said there that, like, black people sometimes have the capacity to just rise above their ignorance, just their ignorance. But then again, when it
yes.
comes to white people in this society, they have to not only rise above their ignorance, but then again, they have to also rise above racism as well. But we're going to go into a break right now from with a song from Sharia Lurie called Mirage. So this is Sharia Lurie entitled Mirage. We'll be right back. Here on Indy Morrell's Dollhouse Radio. Okay, you're listening to, well, me, James Jones, and here with my co-host, Martin C. And we're currently talking about perceptions of African-Americans and others. So give us a call here at area code 646-595-4038. That's area code 646-595-4038. And join the conversation. Let us hear what you think about what we're talking about. So, okay, I guess I was talking lastly what I was saying there about, you know, rising above their environment of ignorance, and then also, well, like
whites
have a tendency to rise above their environment of ignorance face-to-face with racism. Now, you know, to kind of extend this conversation, let us bring up Michelle Obama in this conversation in terms of her speaking at that Tuskegee University graduation ceremony. I mean, I'm not sure if you heard the words that she had, that she was speaking, and or read what she was speaking, but because she was saying what she was saying and primarily just mentioning what black people had to come through because of racism and racist stereotypes, all of a sudden the media is all over her, basically even calling her a racist. This is in terms, again, with perceptions.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw a I saw the speech in its entirety. I saw, read the transcript, and I know that a lot of people, you know, were going after her because of the speech. I think there were even black people that were coming after her because of the speech, and I think the thing is, and I think of the reason a lot of the black people are coming after her in the speech, they even criticized the president, because a lot of people feel like that Obama kind of copped out in his presidency, because here he had this great platform. And a lot of people felt like he had the ability to do a lot of things to address a lot of past ills. And all they seem to do is the Obamas, they do speeches. And I've heard even people who are allies who have said that speeches are fine, but we need a little bit more than that. And you can give all of the, you know, the angry, you know, I'm black and I've been done wrong speeches all you want. But the thing is, you're sitting in a place where your husband has the bully pulpit. You as the first lady have the bully pulpit. But where are some substantive things that could have been done? And like I said, you have people who are even, like I said, who are allies of the Obamas, who have basically criticized them that, okay, you couldn't do more. You could have done more. Your presidency is going to be over basically after 2016, and you could have done more.
But it's still going on, though. It's not 2016 yet. And
you're right. And that you, they still have to, he still has time. Even though at this point, you know, many consider him a lame duck, he still has time. He still has time.
Mm-hmm. But you know what? Like for myself, first off, I would say that I like the man. I mean, I'm proud that that he is our president. I'm proud that that he is black and he is the president of this country. Because in my opinion, that in itself actually is a big push for African. I just say African intelligence, because, I mean, to let the racist, to even just say let the racist tell it, that sounds too local. That sounds too minimal. But let the general white mindset tell it, we don't have a mind. Regardless to how many black people are in college, regardless to what black men and women of intelligence have done, still, we lack the capability, possibility to even have a mind. So with him there, I mean, this is proof positive. I mean, regardless to what that racist person says or does not say, but then again, for black people themselves, I mean, because a lot of us tend to really doubt, because we are fed such negative images about ourselves, and then again, not being able to, you know, cut through all that negativity. To use a phrase, we a lot of times aren't able to see the forest because of the trees, if you understand what I'm saying there.
Right.
But you know, so I'm proud that he is there. However, I also take issue with him for not speaking out and speaking up on racism. I mean, for me personally, policies, that's another issue. But then again, in a real sense, he don't even speak out about racism as he should. And then again, as you said, he does in fact have that bully pulpit, as people call it.
Right.
He act like it's not there, and or this is not what it is. even though, as he knows and as he has said, certain policies that he put forth are the same policies that other presidents have put forth and had been passed. Well, passed, yes, or have been accepted. Accepted and passed and, you know, put into legislation. But because he is doing it, all of a sudden they're against it. You know? So the thing is, he don't ask what's the difference. He just calls it political bipartisanship. But the thing is, it's more than that. I'll just leave it like that. It's more than that, because you have to add that racist, not racial, but that racist mindset to it. And in my opinion, he should call those people out on that. Well, if not just them, let the rest of us know, especially black people who don't know. Let them, well, I'm
saying, excuse me.
Go ahead. Well, I'm saying let them know, because I already know. Because right now, concerning our right perceptions, there are a lot of blacks today. And then again, this is evident by so many black people criticizing, you know, the things that Michelle Obama has said in her speech. What she said wasn't wrong, or let me say, what she said, she wasn't lying. She wasn't exaggerating. She was just telling the truth. But then again, the truth that she was telling past truths, historical truths, and the way that she had linked it to today was that you still are going to have these problems, but you can't let these problems hold you back. That's, to me, that's, for lack of a better word or term, that's wishy-washy. I mean, because there are solutions to these issues, and the thing is, black people need to be told what we are facing. That's just how I see it, because the case in point, going back to those street situations that I have so many of. I mean, I didn't know it was like that when I was coming up. Matter of fact, I didn't know it was like that even in my 20s. I didn't become aware of that nonsense until, like, what, maybe 25, 26, 27. I was around, matter of fact, it was 1987, so therefore I was 30 when I became aware of that nonsense. I mean, I didn't know that, but then again, that's just a part of that racist nonsense that I didn't know about. What about all the other stuff? What about all the other stuff? Sure, I'll say through reading books like Ralph Ellison, I can relate to it intellectually. Understanding it, that's another thing, but I can relate to it. I can say, well, I can understand that, but you know, I haven't been through that yet, so I don't really know about that as he's talking about it. But then again, it came to a point wherein, as I said, I came to know about it, but not as he was talking about it, but he did speak about it. But I have a different perception of what he said than what he did say. But that's another issue. But coming back to Michelle Obama and also Barack Obama, our president, like I'm saying, they should speak more forthright on this issue. And then again, even concerning President Obama, I take issue with how he likes to, how can I put it, have his bread buttered, so to speak, on both sides, in the sense that, you know, when he will talk about, you know, the racism, number one. And then number two, racialism. I'm kind of like separating those two words there because they're not the same. But like when he talks about the racism, let's say from the white perspective, he talks about it how he can understand how whites can think as they think toward blacks, because primarily because of what they see. And then he also says that concerning blacks, the so-called racial aspect, he could understand why blacks do what they do because of historical precedents. But
right.
I disagree with that primarily because the problem stems from racism. That's where the problem stems from. I mean, in a real sense, well, historically speaking, blacks didn't have nothing to do with slavery. Whites did. The only thing that we had to do with slavery was that we were slaves. Whites made us slaves, and they made the laws to keep us slaves. I mean, there's a big difference there. But again, they don't speak about that, in my opinion, as they ought to, which is only, in my opinion, causing further confusion. And then again, at the same time, you know, the racist, they're all over him. To me, in my mind, pushing him all over the place, and he's not saying nothing about it. He just speaks about the lack of bipartisanship, as if that's
well,
all it is.
Well, James, you know something, and I'm going to defend him, and I don't do it very often, but I'll defend him on this. People forget he's a politician. That's why when he got in office, I told people, I said, don't get your hopes up too high because he's a politician.
I follow you.
He's a politician.
There.
He has interests that he has to basically he has interests and things that he has to and people he's accountable to as a politician. You know. So I was not very. I didn't think that the seas would part. And, you know, and the land would heal, you know, like he said in his famous speech. I never thought that was going to happen. And I think that's where a lot of the now, as we're coming into the final year of his, you know, final years of his administration, I think that's where the frustration is. I think that people had false, you know, notions about what his, you know, what this first black presidency would mean. I think people thought that all of a sudden all the issues and all the problems would all of a sudden go away. And me, myself, I'm more of the Tony Brown school of thought that I don't care how white people perceive me. I don't care how they feel about me per se, because people's perception of me can't affect me if I know who I am, and I think that's one of the biggest things when it comes to perceptions of black people, African Americans. I think that our biggest issue is that a lot of us don't know who we are. We don't know who we are. We don't know where we came from. We don't have any sense of history. You know, some of us don't even know who our daddy is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very powerful thing, because if you don't know who your daddy is, who's your granddaddy? Who is his daddy?
But you know something? I mean, somewhat interesting that you bring that up, and in particular that last part about, you know, a lot of us don't even know who our father is, as if
sense of self.
But like
sense
listen,
of self.
But I understand exactly what you're saying there. But like this is something that comes to my mind a lot when I hear people say that. I mean, not like you said, you just said a lot of us don't even know who our father is. But then again, I'm also thinking in terms of, like, a lot of times hearing the racist people, they like to say the people from the right wing talk about illegitimacy in the black community and, single parent homes in the black community, in the sense of these things are the root cause of problems in the black community and therefore problem for society because of the black community. But as I'm saying, when I hear stuff like that, my mind goes back to some history that I've read and history that I've read concerning our enslavement, or let me say our foreparents' enslavement. And in particular, during that time, slaves weren't in families. Well, okay, they may have been in families, but they weren't legal families. Legal families in the sense that the individuals in that family unit could be sold at any moment, and not only sold, but could have their brains dashed out at any moment because of whatever, And well, I'm going elsewhere here. But then again, what I do want to say here is that back during that time, there really was no family structure. But black people still survived. Black children didn't know who their fathers was. Black children weren't sure who their mother was. If their mother was, well, they would know who their mother was if she was there. But because their mother may have been sold off to some other plantation, they didn't even have a mother. But
you
yet,
know something, James?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And my great-great-grandmother, we called her Big Mama. Big Mama actually was raised on a plantation in the South. That story that we've been told about being sold off, that did happen, but it didn't happen as often as it has been told. I remember reading the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. He did basically a study on this.
But
in 1960, let me just finish this. In 1962, only 20% of African American kids were born out of wedlock. That was the lowest percentage of any ethnic group in this country. African Americans were more likely to be in two parent homes than even whites. The crime rate and the African American community was lower than any other areas where ethnic people resided. That means including even white people. Crime rate was lower. This was 1962.
Okay.
No Civil Rights Act, no Voting Rights Act. And I know a lot of people get mad when they hear certain people on the right speak about illegitimacy. But you know something? We may not like the messenger, but if we are truly honest with ourselves, the message isn't actually incorrect. Bill Cosby, until they start shutting him up, was saying the exact same things. There are a lot of people who black were saying that exact same thing about illegitimacy. And if there is a link between illegitimacy and a lot of the things that are going wrong in our community. And we cannot, because we don't like the messengers, we cannot ignore the message. And the thing is, like I said, prior to 1962, there is nobody that can make me a valid argument that the country was more racist in 1962 than it is in 2015. You can't even begin to have me believe the country is more racist now than it was in 1962. And we had a situation where our community was together, may have been segregated because we couldn't go anywhere else, but we had less crime. We had more two-parent. As a matter of fact, African Americans were the highest. We had the highest rate of marriage of any group, of even whites, and the lowest rate of divorce. And this was in 1962. And nobody can tell me, like I said, that with the racism that we had, that other stuff, the fact that over 80% of African American children are born in a one parent home, nobody can tell me that isn't a major factor in a lot of the things that's going on in our community, a lot of the things that are going wrong in our community.
Well, I would say to that.
Now, we might move, you know, that's just my opinion.
I understand exactly what you're saying, but then because you brought up Moynihan and his report, a lot of people have already attacked that report as being nonsense primarily. And
oh yeah, they've been attacking it for years, but the thing is,
but
they've attacked his report, but guess what? His report was basically prophetic, because everything that he said that was going to happen if we didn't address this in the black community, he said this. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan, number one, is not a right winger. He was a liberal progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And a liberal progressive Democrat, so he can't be, nobody can blame him for being a so-called right-wing Bible thumper. This guy was, his report was universally, even Lyndon Johnson, who commissioned the report, he even attacked the report for one of his own guys. But the thing is, now that you look back at that report, everything that he said has borne out into fruition. Everything has, what he said, if things were to happen. And he, it was a canary in the coal mine to the white community, because the white community, he was saying, if the white community didn't start checking on itself, then guess what would happen? So the thing is, the white community got the sniffles, and we end up catching the cold.
Well, I don't know.
So, a lot of people have attacked that report for years.
Well,
but guess what? You cannot argue with the results, because he was absolutely on point.
Well, but you know, he may have been, because basically, not that what he said was so prophetic, but because, let us say that it was just in the cards. I mean, because black people are going to reproduce. And then again, let us say, knowing down the pipeline that there might, let us just assume, maybe we're wrong to assume, that he might have known that there was going to be a prison industrial complex springing up. Maybe he knew this. You know, maybe he knew all of these societal blocks that would be put in the way of black progress, because black people were finally on the move. And he knew how being a liberal and knowing how, you know, the conservative right racist wing was, how they would, you know, fight back against this. He knew what would happen. So therefore,
James, I would even disagree with that term of racist white right wing conservative, because I would say this, because with the, you can trace back a lot of the issues that we've had in this community. A lot of people have traced it back to the liberal war on poverty, the so-called war on poverty that was instituted by Lyndon Johnson. The welfare, where welfare basically took the black man out of the home.
I follow what you're saying.
And all of these programs that came in that was supposed to help poverty. And the thing is, if you look at all these programs that Lyndon Johnson so-called instituted, look 20, 30 years after these programs have hit our community. We got the housing situation. What do we have after that? We had Cabrini Green in Chicago. We had the Cochran Gardens in St. Louis.
But okay, but like
we got the Bowen Homes.
But okay, but like what I would say there is that these are all societal induced situations. And the thing is, black people had nothing to do with that other than being the
victims. Oh no, we were victims
of
it. Yeah, we were victims of it.
Okay, thank you for that.
And you know something? There are even some radicals who say that the worst thing that ever happened to blacks, and can give you studies that show it, that the two worst things that happened to blacks was, number one, forced integration, and number two, Brown versus Board of Education. There are actually studies that show that African American children, even with the books that they had and the inferior facilities, that black children in many cases were outscoring white children in math, science, and English, even with those books, because guess what? They were in all black schools. They had all black teachers. And those black teachers who knew how to teach those children, Isn't it? It's not a shock that you have that school where you have those that all boys black school who's graduated 100% for the past 3 years. They've graduated 100% and sent 100% to college. That's not shocking.
No, well,
we spend the United States has spent, they spend more money per capita in the Western world, spend more money per student. And even because of the Brown versus Board of Education, in those areas where they're still under court order, they spend even more money on African American children. Yet the test scores keep going down. And the thing is, I'm one of those people. I don't look at anecdotal stuff. Show me the numbers, because to me, numbers are the one thing that don't lie. People lie, numbers don't. And I'm telling you, James, there are people that are making the argument, and they are making valid arguments that integration, forced integration, and forcing black kids to go to school with white kids has basically destroyed the educational opportunities for blacks.
Well,
and actually now it's even, and guess what? And now are even the historically bad colleges have suffered.
But you want to know something?
You know, so we are, hey, James, we ought to do a whole show on how big-time college, how when they started integrating big-time colleges with black players, how that completely destroyed, the SWAC and all those other black conferences where all of a sudden they realize these Negroes can play better than the white boys.
But now you're going elsewhere in this. But
I know. I wandered off the plant. Excuse me.
I was about to say
the plantation.
I wandered
off the intellectual plantation, y'all. Excuse me.
Well, the thing is, all that is related. But still,
yes,
what I wanted to yes, it is. What I wanted to have come back to is what you had said. The thing about numbers and all that, and then again, statistically speaking, blacks were better off in segregation. Well, to me, in my opinion, people who argue from that premise, in fact, they're arguing from a negative premise. Why do I say a negative premise? Primarily because they don't know the other situation. Now, what might be the other situation? The other situation might sound somewhat utopian, but if things were as they were, that is, if black people were seen as people, that is, if black people were seen as normal human beings to be mingling with whomever they want to mingle with, and or whomever want to mingle with them. But no, it's not like that. There is an actual element, force, in this country, in this world, that does, in fact, seek to keep black D-O-W-N down, and they will do anything in their power and are doing all in their power to do so. And that is a situation. So therefore, that's why I'm saying people who argue from that premise that we were better off, forced, as you put it and as they put it, forced integration, as if integration, how can I put it, as if integration is silly, as if integration didn't have to be forced. Remember, we were segregated for.
I mean, think about this. Think about Black Wall Street, Rosewood.
Oh,
all black communities that were doing fine.
And what happened
without
there?
Integration?
What happened there? Whites came up.
Oh, they were destroyed.
Wait.
They were destroyed?
No. Okay, I'm jumping the gun. I shouldn't go to why were they destroyed, but more so, let's go back and ask why did they have to be segregated in the first place? Why couldn't we live in the same communities in the first place? What's wrong with people that can't see people as people? That is the issue. That's my opinion. That is the issue.
I definitely feel you on that.
Wait. All right. Wait. I kind of missed that, but then again, come back to that after I say this. You know, people who make that argument, who say that we were better off in segregation than integration. That same argument was made that we were better off in slavery than free, because they said what? They had a place to live. They had health care. You know, they had work, although we weren't paid.
No, I definitely would not call that health care.
But you know,
I would call that health care. Because, you know, when Massa was sick, he got the good doctor.
But,
you know, when we got sick, where the brother from the field got sick, you know, they might have said, if Doc was cool with working on black folks, he'll do it. But, you know, the master like, hey, we ain't paying you nothing extra.
But well, it's good that we could laugh at that, because you know exactly what I'm saying. You have those You have those people, liberal whites also, you know, back then talking about, well, you're better off enslaved than not, because if you go free, what you gonna do? Where you gonna work? Right now you got a job, you're being fed, you got clothing. You know, come on. and now that's that same argument, but only updated. Maybe updated is the wrong word, but let's use the word, that's the same argument, but like only nuanced into a new situation. And like that is with integration. So no,
right.
I would disagree with that. Totally. But again, this goes into, you know, well, like perceptions. You know, how do we perceive ourselves? And then again, you know, how do others perceive us as well? And then again, as you had just said, you know, some of us feel that, you know, we were better off, we were doing better in a segregated situation than we are now. But then again, we are not doing well now. Well, most of us, or let's put it this way, we're not doing as well as we thought we would be doing outside of a segregated system. But again, that's not our fault. Again, we have that same element that is there to push back whatever we are trying to do. But then again, they will create a new system. Michelle Alexander spoke about this new system in her book, The New Jim Crow. I still haven't read all of that book yet, but I do, in fact, plan to read it. And that's where she speaks about, you know, the school-to-prison pipeline. And so many people speak about that today, wherein it's an actual situation. Because, well, they don't really teach kids in school. I mean, you know, a lot of people come. I mean, even when I was coming up, you had guys, and I guess girls too, coming up out of elementary who couldn't even read, going to junior high.
Oh, yeah.
Can't even read. And then again, leaving high school, couldn't even read. But somehow, they will go to college. I wonder how that happened. But okay, wow, we have missed the break.
Was getting into this one here.
Yeah, we supposed to have had a break at 11:25, but we didn't do that. So, Angela, because I just heard my phone in tone, and so I wonder what we're going to do now.
Go ahead and cue us to break, Angela.
So okay,
we need to get that little thing in our ear.
Okay, so she said, all right. Angela saying, all right, we're gonna take a break at 11:45. Okay.
All right, cool. You know, hey, excuse us. You, as you can see, this show is kind of like one of those old 70s frontline shows where, you know, the guys are sitting up having a long conversation, and, you know, we got the, you know, that little half cigarette butt that's just about to fall off the cigarette while we sitting there in the smoky studio, you know, having the talk.
I've seen that I've even seen one of those situations with James Baldwin. But, you know,
I was thinking about that with James Baldwin. I was thinking, whose show was he on? I was trying to think of whose show was he on, James Baldwin. Whose show was he on with that?
Well, it might have been that Cabot person, Dave Cabot.
Dick Cabot.
Okay, Dick Cabot. Yeah.
Yeah, that's when they let you smoke on TV back in those days. And they sitting there puffing on cigarettes and having a, you know, deep intellectual conversation.
Mm-hmm.
They don't doubt.
Well, about things going on at that time in that day.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
But yeah, but
well, I'll let you go ahead and take us to break to our last music break of the night.
But okay, but we've got like another minute before we go on into that break. But again, this has all to do again with, you know, perceptions. You know,
there you go, perceptions.
Our own, and then again, others who interact with ourselves. So right now, it is in fact 11:45. So we're going to have the break with Myla J. Champion with her song entitled Champion. So this is Myla J. Champion with her song Champion. We'll be right back. Okay, the song should be coming out any minute. We don't want to just... There we go.
One minute you the best, okay. The next you my ex.
Okay.
I swear you try me on purpose. I swear we need a ref.
Okay.
But baby, I am a champion. Lay back out, ease all the stress. I hit it from the right, hit it from the left. Lick it from the right, lick it from the left.
All myself and this nigga acting
crazy.
Fair boom like a boxing ring at each other's necks all day. Talking all this
shit,
trying to get you to stay. Kissing all up on my face, keep trying to call me babe. It's war with the roses, I hate you, I love you, I fight you, then fuck you. Sometimes I can feel like you really my nigga, but then I'm like, fuck you. The way that you kissing, the way that you fight it, remind me of the Tyson. I'm heated, but I need it on
you up in here like. We up in here like
all day, nigga. All day, nigga. How long you niggas ball? All day, nigga. How much time you spent at the mall? All day, nigga. How many runners do you got on call? All day, nigga. Swish. How long they keep you in call? All day, nigga. Take you to get this fly? All day, nigga. Tell your P.O. how long you been high? All day, nigga. Now already know I'm straight from the shaft. All day, nigga. All day, nigga. This shade, nigga. Shopping for the winner and the checks made, nigga. Ball so hard, man, the shit crazy, nigga. He ain't getting money that you got eight figures. But at Jesus Peace, man, I been say, nigga. Just talk to FedCon, that's Sensei, nigga. Told him I been on 10 since the 10th grade, nigga. Got a middle finger longer than the 10, baby, nigga. I don't let them play with me. I don't let them talk to me no kind of way. They better watch what they say to me. Nigga still getting popped on the day to day. Yeah, I still got the 100 with a small face, nigga. Might spend 50 racks in my off day, nigga. You a fake Denzel like the all say, nigga. If you're running to me, better have off say. You a Rico Suave, nigga. Round, listen to Sade, nigga. If you ain't with us, you an our way, nigga. You a actor, you should be on Broadway, nigga. Cause you do shit to Broadway, nigga. Your bitch got an ab, I'm a Broadway sticker. Late for the class in the hallway, nigga. You the dropout at it as always, nigga. As always. All day, nigga. How long you ball? All day, nigga. How much time you spent at the mall? All day, nigga. How long it take you to get this fly? All day, nigga. Take your P.O. How long you been high? All day, nigga. Post some here and for my niggas that died. All day, nigga. And I keep a bad bitch on the patch at the side. All day, nigga. Now already know I'm straight to the shop. All day, nigga. Chop. All day, nigga. I can do this all day, boy.
Woo!
I'm finna turn this bitch out. Any day, yay, in the streets, boy.
Woo!
It been a motherfucking draft. Don't really matter what I made, boy.
Woo!
You know I still go wild. Like a light-skinned slave, boy.
Woo!
We in the motherfucking house. Right now, looking real stuff right now. I swear I've been on the slide. Like, I'm off right now. Super niggas getting money for a jump right now. Shout out to Jackie Chan, I need to stunt right now. They be looking at the gram, I be looking at the Grammys like, huh? That's us right now.
Right now.
24/7, 365 days, everybody getting paid.
Go crazy.
Niggas looking at me like I'm worth both them J's. People saying, yeah, yeah, take it easy. 20 G's for the Yeezys off of eBay. Niggas do the most and they ain't done shit. Only way I can sum it up, son, bitch.
Hands up, 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 hands up.
All day, nigga.
I took a young sweetbread and I reached into my shirt. Gave him what I had left. At that moment, I dispersed. At that moment, I dispersed. Pillow, pillow, pillow.
Welcome back to Dollhouse Radio. You listen to Urban Society, and we're back. So I guess we're let us jump forward to another issue, and that is concerning the Baltimore thing with that that prosecutor there. You know, well, right now they're talking about some of those cops might be let off because they're saying that something about the knife actually being illegal, and therefore,
right.
Being that the state prosecutor, this Marilyn Mosby, said the knife was legal, they're thinking that based upon the technicality of it actually being illegal, that she therefore charged them erroneously. But you know, concerning that, when I hear that, I think like this: they talking about the knife. Are they saying that the guy, Freddie Gray, had the knife actually out, pointing it at them? And if he didn't have the knife out, how do they know he had a knife? You follow what I'm saying?
Right, right. Well, you know something, and also, you guys, we are going to have a future show where we're going to talk about, you know, the criminal justice system, because you know that we can do about 5 shows on that.
Definitely.
But from what I've been reading on the situation in Baltimore is that she may have erroneously charged them because in this, and everybody, this is going into the legal weeds, you know, this is some stuff you might hear on court TV, if you know we still had court TV. But what they're talking about is that she charged them with murder too, which is depraved indifference. And it may be that the officers may have been what we call negligent, meaning that they, you know, they may have not shackled him down in that bus like they should have, but that depraved indifference means that is in your mind, you meant to cause somebody harm. It's like, and that's the difference between in that jurisdiction, murder two and murder one. Murder one means you set out, you know, you plan to do somebody harm. You plan to kill somebody. And murder two, which is, you know, depraved indifference. That means that you just basically care. In your mind, you set out to do something. You may not have planned for them to be killed, but you set out in your mind to do them some sort of harm. You may not have meant for them to be killed. And the thing is that a lot of the people, the legal experts, and I know that former O.J. Simpson lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, he wrote an op-ed piece. I think it was in either New York Times or the Washington Post or something like that. And he basically said that the prosecutor may have overcharged the case, that in this case, it's not even enough to be manslaughter.
But you know what?
Less murder, too.
But, you know, Not having any legal background, but then again, just understanding.
Oh, hey, trust me, I haven't been to law school either. So,
just understanding what words mean, and then again, you know how they apply these terms. I can see where murder two would apply, such as the fact that because the Baltimore police, as it has been said, has established a precedent wherein they would just throw somebody in the back of the van and give them what they have termed a rough ride, as if it's something funny, you know. And then now in this guy's Gray's situation, he was already hurt. He couldn't even walk to the van, two of them had to help him in there to lay him down, and then they're gonna rough ride him like that. Depraved indifference, or what do they call it? Depraved heart murder. I'm laughing, but the nuance.
I agree with you. It's a sad situation. The thing is that number one is gonna be extreme, and this is where when Alan Dershowitz, this is not a guy here who when Alan Dershowitz starts talking about stuff like that, number one, he's one of the most preeminent legal minds. This dude he's been before the Supreme Court a gazillion times. This is not a guy who you can just shrug him off as, you know, one of the so-called, this guy's got more brothers off than anything. He is a guy who not only he's taken O.J. Simpson on, but he's taken on a lot of famous rich white clients and then turned around and used that money to help get brothers off who can't even afford a lawyer of his magnitude. So when you got somebody like Alan Dershowitz, when he starts attacking the prosecutor, I got to start looking at it a little bit funny, because this is a man who he's not one of those white attorneys who you can look at and go, oh, yeah, he's just one of the establishment. Alan Dershowitz, you know, he's not somebody he's somebody that people in the legal community, whether you agree with him or not, on his legal philosophy. This is a guy who Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia, who are right-wing judges, they respect him.
Okay, well, I follow what you're saying. But at the same time, I mean, you building this guy up like that, in a real sense, I guess you're not meaning to, but in essence, you're tearing down this Marilyn Mosby person considerably, as if, you know, she really don't know what she's doing, which I really, well, not knowing, but then again, just based upon what she's done thus far, and even the charges that she's brought, I would figure that she's knowing something. And then again, let us not forget that all these people, excluding, let us say, Dershowitz right now, but then again, these people who are talking about she possibly has charged these police officers erroneously, this is coming from, you know, the police people themselves, and also those lawyers who are defending.
Oh, yeah, the police union.
Police.
Yeah, the police,
and
yeah.
And again, this is...
You
this
expect
is,
that.
Yeah, you... Well, exactly. It's their job to say these things. So therefore, I would think that she more so knows what she's doing than not. And also, she also had her own investigators to investigate this particular issue. So as it was said, she got the police report, but at the same time, she had already been investigating, and then she had her own report. And based upon her own report, not the police report, did she go on and file those charges.
Right.
So that's...
Yeah, like I said, we're going to see. And the thing is, I was speaking with a local lawyer friend of mine, and... excuse me, and we were talking about this, and we kind of equated to a couple of trials that have, you know, sensational trials that have been going on, and two cases where the prosecution may have overcharged, and one of them, of course, the Casey Anthony case, and another, which is the George Zimmerman case.
Okay, but Martin, right now we have run out of time. It's at that hour.
Yes, it is. It is about that time.
So we're going to have to sign off and say to our listeners that we will hear them. They will hear us again next week, and we hope that they will call in to join our conversation.
Yes, please. We'll see you guys next week. Thank you for calling and listening.
Urban Society.